Hey everybody, Gregory Connolly here with another edition of the Your Video Store Shelf podcast here at yourvideostoreshelf.com. Now, seeing as how this is our 33rd show, I believe that it's time to switch up gears. Typically, the last 32 shows have been used to promote a new film, get a new director out on the show, or an old director who's ready to keep making movies. On the show today, however, we have a guy who, his days in film are, it seems to be, long over, and he was a big part of the wonderful company that was City Lights and PM Entertainment, especially in the early days. Richard Muncheon, how you doing?
Doing very well, thank you.
And now that I asked that question, are you ever looking to get back into film?
Yeah, I am, if the right situation came along. Like most people who are in a business that is also an art, many of them enjoy what they do, but really don't like the business end of what they do. And that was the case with me. I've been very much in control of my life, and in film business, or in any of the arts, you're not in control of when you work. So while I very much like making films, I very much dislike the process of trying to find an agent, pitching projects that are just never going to be made.
And you especially did take control of your life, because aren't you a professional blackjack player?
I always needed a reliable income because film business, up and down. So my reliable fallback job was professional gaming.
And considering PM was based in Las Vegas, I guess that didn't hurt you before you moved out to California.
Actually, that's not true. PM originally City Lights. Started, the first offices were in Van Nuys, California, and
I remember Paul Volk, the editor, telling me about how you guys were across the street from Hollywood Video, the porn company.
Yeah, that's true, and Joseph had been living in Las Vegas, which is where I knew him. We were at acting school, so that was the Vegas connection.
And let's hear a little bit about the career of Richard W. Muncheon, because I imagine that, sadly, most of the people listening to this aren't all that familiar with you.
Sadly. Where do you want to start?
Let's hear about just you got your start with Joseph Murphy.
Let me back up just a little bit. I went to Columbia College in Chicago with a degree in theater, and my intent was to come out here and become an actor. And when I got here and started, looking for acting work, we moved here at about the same time, and Joe had chosen a different path, which was to, he wanted to make films. And so when he did eventually, put together to make films, we were good friends, and so I was there helping him. And in my own case, I found out very quickly that acting in film and television and commercials was very different than my experience doing stage, and I found out that I really didn't like it. It was not the same, and did not offer the same rewards, so I happened to be in the right place at the right time and kind of shifted over into the, production side of film instead of being in front of the camera.
What
happened was Joe made a film, Hollywood in Trouble, which I acted in, and from that, Rick Pepin, who was the director of he was the cinematographer, I guess, or the the camera operator who became the cinematographer on that first film.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story.
Yeah. The original DP got fired, and Joseph had hired Rick knowing that he might be firing the DP, and sure enough, that happened. And so Rick ended up finishing the film. And what happened was Rick, that film was a comedy, Hollywood in Trouble, which Joe was unable to sell. And but he was in the right place at the right time. It was just the very, very beginning of the video boom. People were just starting to get VCRs in their homes. And Rick had been making swimming tapes, 8mm, 16mm swimming films for a guy with a sports company in Canada. And Rick showed it to the guy, and the guy said, you know, wow, if you can make a film like this for $70,000, I'll put up the money, you know, we'll form a company, I'll put up the money to make four more films, and but we have to make action movies, because that's what everybody wants to buy. And that was how City Lights was formed. So, and I was just sort of there as a friend. I mean, we had nothing to do with the company. I was just, you know, a friend of Joe's, and, you know, it was this new thing, and we were just having fun in my mind, you know. It was like, oh, this is cool, let's do this, you know. So anyway, when City Lights was formed, we did the first four movies, and the partner, the money guy, said, yeah, let's keep doing them. I think we made 8 or 9 movies the first year. We just started cranking them out, and I was I was kind of the production manager / art department / wardrobe department / you know, caterer. at least on the first film. On the first film, I think the crew was only 7 or 8 people. And, you know, it was sort of learn as you go. I mean, Rick really knew his job. He'd been shooting for a long time. And we had a professional sound man. But the rest of us really, you know, I mean, it was kind of on-the-job training. So I and each film we would add a few more crew people, so I wasn't trying to do all those things, you know, on the subsequent films. But so I did, I think, 7 or 8 films that way, and then Joe gave me the opportunity to write and direct. And I was the first person other than Joe to direct for the company.
Yeah, you got that that little piece of notoriety because Joe, for the first, I believe it was 12 films or 10, actually, yeah, I think you cited it as in the email that we exchanged. I think we figured out that it was like 9 films that Joe produced, directed, and typically wrote in a coffee shop the day before
that's
year.
True. And yeah, I would often help Joe with the writing, and we would he had a little one-bedroom apartment in Glendale, California, and, you know, we would go sit in his house in the morning and work, and then we would go walk in the Glendale Galleria, which was a block away, and there was a particular coffee shop, too, on Colorado Boulevard that was that was popular.
And what's notable, really, about Joe is that a lot of people that wind up producing a lot of movies before they started producing, they were actually doing something within the film industry. Joe actually took that whatever amount of money, $50,000, $70,000 that he took to make Hollywood in Trouble, and that was his first experience really on a film set aside from hanging out at a few different sets.
That's true. Joe, as I say, we were in acting school in Las Vegas, and we moved to L.A. in 83. And Joe spent a lot of time just hanging out on movie sets, trying to learn everything he could. So he really had no experience. He owned 3 pizza places in Las Vegas, and, you know, that was his prior experience. And also, it's really kind of amazing that this guy who has written I don't know how many writing credits he has to his name, 30, 40, something. You know, English was not his first language. You know, he came over from Syria when he was young. I mean, an adult in his 20s. And, you know, so, yeah, he had no experience in the film business. English was a second language. And yet, you know, here he's made, whatever, 100 movies and written 30 or 40 or... Pretty amazing story.
So when we get started in the business, it's like 1986 or so, and Hollywood in Trouble's in the can, and then you here comes, God, I forget.
Mayhem was the first one.
Yeah, here comes Mayhem with the money from the Canadian guy whose name is slipping my mind right now.
Ron Gilchrist.
Yeah, Ron Gilchrist, who I have not been able to track down.
I think he was from Toronto. He's Canadian, so... and I can't remember the name. He had a sporting goods company. I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll figure it out off the air. So, with Mayhem, you guys are told that the world wants action. So you guys went out there and produced an action film. And Mayhem, to this day, lives on in my heart as a special kind of movie.
Why is that? What was that?
Just because it features Ray Martino... in his largest role, pretty much. And he screams at a cat at one point in the movie. That's going to be up on YouTube soon. It's a tremendous, tremendous clip. And then just all the wackiness, like Ray Martino sticking a sawed-off shotgun up Gene Levine's dress and blowing it.
Oh, yeah.
And what else was there in good old Mayhem?
And that was all justified because, of course, they were child pornographers or something.
They were dope. They were dope pushers and child molesters, and that's
child
just
molesters.
Wrong. And you know, the first time I watched that, I was so confused because usually the point of the bad guy in the beginning scene is that they're not as bad as the bad guys that they're soon going to encounter. Because you just, all you're doing there is you're killing off the movie early. But it didn't matter that Joe was necessarily doing that because when people would pop in the movies to see, do we want to buy this and sell it in Eastern Europe? They were going to be the most impressed by the first 10, 15 minutes. And as a result, there was always action to be had.
Oh, yeah. There was very much a formula which, you know, started out with you must have a big action scene at the beginning, and then there must be some kind of action at least every 10 minutes. And as the company progressed, the action had to get closer and closer together and bigger and bigger. although the biggest scene was usually the opening of the movie. And another thing that sort of became odd was the foreign market just had some very strange ideas about film. And I remember one time George, who later became the guy who sold the movies in the foreign market, came and said, "The movie looks cheap. It's all shot at night." And we explained to him that it's actually more expensive to shoot at night because you need much more lights and you know, we thought that was a better, more interesting look. No. Looks cheap if it's shot at night. So this was, of course, direct feedback from buyers. But, I that was so long ago. But I remember that movie, Mayhem, we, again, you know, it was the first time we had ever dealt with stunts or special effects. And in an effort to save money, and these movies were always about saving money. So... Mayhem, I think, was shot in 7 days. We would order the equipment for 1 week, and we would tell them that we're starting very early on Monday morning, so we'd have to pick up the equipment Friday afternoon. And that allowed us to shoot from Friday afternoon for 9 straight days, you know, and then return the equipment on that following Monday morning. And but in the case of Mayhem, I think we finished a day or two early, you know, just because every day earlier that Joe finished would be one less day he had to pay the crew. So anyway, we this was our first experience with stunts and special effects, and there were four different, you know, bits involving stunts and effects. And so we decided that the best, you know, financially, the best way to do that was to shoot them all on the same day. And the last of the four was being shot in Rick Pepin's mother-in-law's house, Angie Tondo, who also owned the restaurant that was in the movie where we shot somebody. And by the end of it, we had been shooting for 23 hours. And the effects guy overfilled the blood packs of those people in that house, which part of that scene you're talking about with Gene Levine and the shotgun, that was Angie's house. And years later, Angie would say, you know, I found blood inside one of the cabinets today, under the cabinet, inside. And there was just blood everywhere in that house. And I remember being on my hands and knees, you know, after 23 hours, mopping up blood, saying to the first AD who was helping me, is this the glitter or the glamour of the movie?
And Laurel Fest, actually, she was the script supervisor from the early days up until God knows how long. Laurel was telling me a story that was actually relayed to her through Joe, that said that when he and Rick were making Hollywood in Trouble, Joe would want to let people off after 8 hours, and it was Rick that had to kind of tell him, hey, it's 12 hours.
Yeah, right. And again, you know, just we didn't know. You know, there was so much we didn't know.
And I guess making 9 movies in a year or whatever the hell you guys managed to crank out was the best learning experience you could actually have.
Yeah, absolutely. also the post-process back then, this was before there were Avids. So the movies were edited on video. And we actually had to I don't want to get into too arcane descriptions of editing, but every shot had these key numbers in little windows, when you edit. And we literally had to write those numbers down by hand. Every single shot. It was pretty amazing.
I had no idea that you guys had to go to such measures for a City Lights movie.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a movie that I just watched the other night that no one actually listened to, I'm sure, has ever seen. The Glass Jungle, which featured the boxer, what was his name? Lee Canalito, who had a very good professional record and managed to get a role in Paradise Alley with Sylvester Stallone. And then his two roles in PM Entertainment movies were pretty much the last of his film career.
Yeah, this was, to satisfy the foreign market, they wanted two things, you know, action and names. And this was an attempt at, maybe the foreign market watches boxing, or we can always say, you know, he starred with Sylvester Stallone in this movie, Paradise Alley or whatever. That was the idea behind casting him. not a very good actor, to say the least.
That movie features so many sad, dreamy montages of Lee Canalito making out with his woman.
You know, this was another discovery of Joe's around that time was, you can fill, you know, 2 or 3 minutes at a time with a piece of music, and, it's much faster to shoot things that don't involve dialogue, because, you know, those pesky sound men always want it to be quiet when you're trying to, you know, record sound. But if you just have, you know, Pam Dixon pushing a shopping cart through a grocery store for a couple of minutes with a piece of music, you know, you filled up a couple of minutes of the movie.
Those are always great.
So, yeah, you find as the movies went on, they had more and more of those montages.
And one of the things I think you mentioned to me in the past was that as time went on, the foreign buyers also wanted more inventive ways of people being killed, because all you had for movies and movies was squibs getting blown. And
oh, yeah.
Glass Jungle actually features the villain being killed by a miniature crossbow.
Yeah, and there's one of those early films where it was a scuba spear. Somehow this guy just happened to have this scuba spear, you know, in his living room. You could always justify, gee, honey, are you going on a scuba diving trip next week? You know. it was really laughable. But, yes, we called it, sometimes in the script it would say, you know, he breaks into the house and kills 9 guys in new and interesting ways.
That is like, that's got to be like the headline for all my PM Entertainment coverage. Just an actual page from a script that says, gets into a house and kills people in 9 inventive ways.
Yeah. I mean, that was the other thing about the scripts that we had is, I did a movie much later called Deadly Bet. And when I was given the script, it was 42 pages long. And if you see the movie, the last 30 minutes of the current movie was encapsulated with the line, he goes to the tournament and wins. So, the scripts were often very sparse.
And Deadly Bet is actually a fine, fine film that is available on DVD. It's with the great Jeff Wincott, who I've tried to mention on this show a few times.
Jeff was very good. Stephen Vincent Lee was in that, Charlene Tilton. That was actually a fun film for me to do, although the first, you know, there's just like a million fights in a ring in that movie, and the first stuff that we shot in one of the warehouses there in Van Nuys in July, and it, you know, was like 120 degrees in that ring. We have this big light over the ring, and it was 100 some degrees outside. So the first few days were pretty awful, but I had a lot of fun on that movie.
And so while we're in the game of talking about your directing, let's talk a little bit about your directorial debut, the first non-Joseph Merhi directed City Lights movie, Dance or Die.
Yeah, wow. must we talk about it?
Oh, we must.
Yeah. You know, as I say, you know, we had just been cranking out all these movies, and he told me I was going to get the opportunity to do a film. So in between all this other stuff, I had to come up with a script. And I was interested in doing something that had dance in it because I had one of the early ADs for the, like on Mayhem and a lot of the early movies, the first AD was a very big choreographer and director in Las Vegas named Minnie Madden. And she later went on to be vice president of Ice Capades and got into ICE. But we had been partnered doing shows for Japan where we would send, you know, 6 or 8 dancers and a singer or whatever to Japan, and they would do these resort hotels there. And so I was interested in dance, so I thought, all right, action, throw in some dancers. You know, oh, that was another part of the formula was you always had to have, you know, some amount of good-looking women and nudity.
Of course.
Along with the action sequences. I came up with Dance or Die, and I wanted to shoot it in Las Vegas just for a couple of reasons. One, you know, at that time, if you went to a grocery store in Los Angeles and said, we'd like to shoot in your grocery store, they would say, okay, it's $600 an hour. Oof. If you went anywhere else out of Los Angeles and said, you know, we want to shoot in your grocery store, they would say, oh, great, do you want us to close it for you? Do you want our employees to come in and help? You know, and it would be completely free. So I knew I could get a lot of stuff for free in Las Vegas. The downside of it was I would lose a travel day because they had to bring the equipment in and take it back. So, you know, I think I had 9 days to shoot the movie. And you know, when you were talking about no experience, I had been on 8 movie sets or whatever up until this time, but I had really never thought about directing at all. And I remember the first day I was completely overwhelmed, just completely overwhelmed. And part of that was the planning that I had done was mostly about the dance sequences and not about the first day of shooting. So, you know, I think most first-time directors do get overwhelmed, but boy, that's the only word I can use to describe it. You know, you have 18 people coming up to you constantly saying, should this be red or blue? Should this be in that corner or over against the wall? How, you know, where do you want the camera? Where do you want this? It's, but I got through it. I got through it.
And you got to direct a few action sequences along the way, such as one where a man on a motorcycle drives through the desert and then has his face blown off.
Yeah, actually, that was just, I mean, and again, you know, this action stuff is really just like boys with toys. I mean, stuntmen and sex guys are really just the way we were when we were about 11 years old. And, you know, we get to blow stuff up and, you know, drive around doing this cool thing. The thing that was neat about that car that just went flying through the desert, you know, flipping over many times, was it was a technique that I don't think they even use it anymore. Maybe they do, but it can be dangerous. It's called a cannon roll. And they actually build a cannon into the back of the car facing down. And they put a piece of a telephone pole in there with a big explosive charge. So you know, so you basically have this big bomb in the back of your car.
Oh.
You get the car skidding sideways, and you fire this cannon, which shoots this telephone pole down into the ground, which flips the car up in the air. And so that was just loads of fun to do that.
And you were saying, go on.
The other thing was these stuntmen, these were two guys named, there was this guy, Curry Genovese, who was the stunt coordinator. But the guys behind the special effects and who had really had a lot of experience with stunts were these guys named the Kirby brothers, two brothers. And they had just done a lot of stuff on their own because they were in.
Munch?
I'd never seen before that we used in the film. One of them was in, like with the dancers and things, they would take a shotgun with a blank in it and put condoms filled with blood in it and actually fire the condoms out, you know, causing this blood to, you know, appear on the person. And this way you didn't have to use a squib. And they had come up with this faceplate in the motorcycle helmet effect, and they had showed it to me, and I was like, "Oh yeah, that's really cool. Let's do that." And the actor that played that role in the movie was my brother.
Didn't know that.
Piece of trivia there, yeah.
And then, by the way, these clips for those listening are going to be linked on the YourVideoStoreShelf.com website, so I'm going to talk about them. There are two other scenes in The Great Dancer Die. I'll go with this one first. The famous scene, or famous in my own mind, scene where there are women dancing, and then squibs explode.
Now, are you talking about the ones with the sunglasses?
Yes.
Okay, so those aren't squibs. Those are actually this technique of firing the condoms of blood shotgun at them. Because you couldn't put squibs under those. They're wearing just kind of T-shirts.
Yeah, like, now that I look at it, I can see them. I would wonder how that would happen.
Yeah. You know, I mean, looking back and sounding silly, you know, this was going to be some, you know, interpretive dance with some, you know, sort of comment on the violence that was going on in the choreographer, because the lead character is a choreographer in the film, and he's creating these dances while all this mayhem is going on in his personal life, and so that was supposed to be reflected in his work. And obviously, none of that actually is understood by the audience watching the film, but that was the intent.
City Lights movies generally don't have a subtext to them.
Well, yes, that's true.
And then, of course, with Dance or Die, there was the song Dance or Die, which I assume was produced by PM composer John Gonzalez.
John Gonzalez, who did, God, I don't know, 50 movies or something, or...
Well, that song actually, it's going to open up the podcast. So did John just come
for that one?
Did John just come to you when you guys were in post and say, "I have a song for you"?
You know what? I think he did. I do know that for the 4 dance numbers, I went to him ahead of time and said, I'm going to have 4 dance numbers, and, you know, this is the type of music I need, you know. But the song Dance or Die, yeah, I think it was exactly that. I think, you know, he just came up with it in post.
Does anyone know where John came from? Because I would think that he may have been another one of the imports from the porn industry.
Yeah, he was.
Okay.
That is where he came from.
I wonder if he's still working in that business today, because he kind of disappeared about 10 years ago.
I don't know, but coincidentally, I have a son who's now 13, and he started playing basketball when he was about 9. And I ran into John at a number of basketball games, and he lives in the same town I live in now.
Oh.
And he has a son who's my son's age. So I assume he's still in music, but I really don't know. Although, if I talk to him, I will ask him what he's doing now.
Yeah, and pass him my number, because the man who composed Dance or Die is a friend of the B world.
The show.
Yeah, of the show. So in the end, how do you think Dance or Die was received? Did Joe like it?
Well, for the foreign market, I think it was received the same as all the others. You know, I don't think they thought it any better or any worse. Joe was not a very complimentary guy to work for. And, I remember one time, very early on, I went to him in the office and I said, you know, people are working for nothing. I mean, I think my salary on Mayhem was $300. So I said to him, you know, you need to go tell people they're doing a good job. You know, you just need to say, hey, you're doing a good job and thank you and I appreciate it. And he said, if you tell them that, they'll want more money. And I said, no, it's the opposite. They'll be okay to work for no money if they feel like they're appreciated. And it just, you know, I guess there are just different business styles, and that was his. So I think as a business strategy, his idea was, you know, sort of, tell people they're doing a bad job, because then you can get them to work for less money. And in my own case, you know, just to give you an example of what it was like, I did a movie called Ring of Fire, which I was told by George, who was the salesperson, that it was kind of a movie that elevated the company in the foreign buyer's eyes. But when we watched the final cut of the movie, he called me into his office and told me how much he did not like the movie and all the mistakes he thought I made, and literally in the same breath said, but I have another movie for you to do in July called Deadly Dead. I'm going to do it.
And of course, no pay raise.
Oh, no, of course, no. Yeah, of course not. But again, you know, I wasn't there for the money, and most people were not there for the money. The really good thing about PM was you could learn whatever craft you wanted to learn, and they literally had people go from PA to producer, from PA to cinematographer, from PA to director in, you know, a year or less, or maybe 2 years for, in some cases. But you literally could learn any job you wanted to learn. And I thought that was actually a great trade-off. You know, I mean, who else would give me the opportunity with no experience to direct a movie? And so I was willing to, you know, work for no money or very little money all that time. But again, I was fortunate enough, you know, to have a method of earning a living at the same time.
Sure, that didn't hurt. And as you were saying, people could learn their craft. And unlike with the early days of Roger Corman, which is pretty much something that can't be duplicated, the people who worked for PM, they didn't go on to make millions of dollars a year, maybe except for Joe. But many of them, even people that were around in the City Lights days, they came on, they learned, and now they have steady good positions in Hollywood doing their craft, like,
absolutely.
Like Judy Yonemoto, who did all the makeup for the first many City Lights movies. She, I think, did all 7 seasons of Malcolm in the Middle.
Yeah, Scott McAvoy went on to Scott McAvoy and Gil's last name. They went on. They became the producers of that Howard Stern show, Son of a Beach, and they had a couple of other shows that they set up their own company and became television producers, which is very lucrative. I mean, yeah, there are a lot of people who came out of City Lights who have careers now, or City Lights at PM, who have careers now because of the craft they learned there. Absolutely.
And before we get going, let's hear a little bit about your post-PM career, in which you directed a few movies that, actually, it was between your PM gig, sort of. You directed a few movies for another producer who, from the very start, intended on selling those films to Joe.
No. No, that's... Are you talking about Century Film Partners?
I guess so. The Fists of Iron and Evil Obsession.
Okay, so what happened was, the last film I did for PM was a film with Cynthia Rothrock called Guardian Angel. And I was filming it at a mansion in Malibu. And the owner of the house, Mike Hall, who was our sound man forever, going all the way back to the second movie, Epitaph.
And he was Laurel's husband, sadly passed away.
Yes. But Mike came to me and he goes, you know, the owner of this house is asking me a lot of questions about you. And I was like, oh, okay. So anyway, the guy asked me to have lunch after the movie was over. And he wanted to form a company like PM Entertainment and make low-budget films and sell them to the foreign market. And so I said, okay. Now, unfortunately, you know, just the opposite of what happened with Joe, it turns out we got in right as the low-budget film market was right when it was on the decline. And so, you know, we made 6 films, and as I say, the market was on the decline, and, you know, so I got out of it. But the intent was not to sell them to Joe. It was to sell them, you know, the same way, was to try to duplicate the PM model. But we were not able to do that. And at that point, either sometime after that, neither was PM. I mean, the market had changed. And when that company ended, when Century Film Partners dissolved, I then went into television. Joe was doing a television show that was on TNT called L.A. Heat, or L.A. Vice.
L.A. Heat.
L.A. Heat, I think it was called, yeah. And so I went and started doing episodes of that. And actually, I have to tell you, this because, again, this is a typical, this is so, you know, defining of PM. I went in, I was doing, this was like episode number 40 of the show or something. So they've been doing it for a couple of years. I did the first episode. I mean, I did my first episode. At the end of the episode, they come to me and they say, of the 40 episodes we've done, this is the first time that a director has done an episode that we do not have to go out afterwards and shoot pickups. The episode is complete in the can as you shot it. And I was like, well, yeah, isn't that supposed to be the way it is? You know? So anyway, they said, so we want to make you we want to hire you permanently as like the head director, and you'll direct like every other episode, and we'll give you a year contract or something like that. And we'll pay you X. And X was less than what I was making on the per episode basis. And I said, wait a minute. So you're telling me that you want to, that I'm doing such a good job that you want to hire me permanently to pay me less money? And they were like, well, yeah, but you'd be guaranteed a lot of work. So, I mean, that is the quintessential PM attitude, you know. You're doing such a good job, we want to pay you less, but make you work harder.
And it seems like finding work got harder and harder as time went on.
It did. It did get – I mean, what happened was I ended up doing three episodes of that show, and it got canceled. And then I moved to a show that was on Animal Planet, and I did six episodes of that show, and it got canceled. And then I just hit a wall. I couldn't find work. And part of the problem, I think, was unfortunately, PM on the resume was not a positive. It was a negative, I think. You know, and for whatever reason, you know, I just found it very hard to get work. And I just didn't want the aggravation. I was tired of calling people who didn't return my calls, you know, pitching ideas to people who had no intention of buying them. And I said to my producer friends, look, if somebody wants to call and hire me, I'm happy to work, but I'm no longer willing to do this. So I went and wrote a book called Gambling Wizards.
I was just about to get the plug out there. It is on Amazon.com. We will link to it. It is called Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers. What is this book about?
It's a collection of interviews, seven men and one woman, of professional gamblers, all people who have made tens of millions of dollars gambling professionally over at least 20 years. These are not people who, like, win a bunch of money one day and lose it the next. These are professional, solid professional people who do this for a living. And it covers various aspects of gambling. Some of the big poker players are in there, like Doyle Brunson and Chip Reese. The biggest sports bettor uses computer modeling to bet sports. Same guy who has made $200 million betting horse racing using a computer model. A guy who runs a professional blackjack team. Backgammon players.
Well, before we go, give us three tips that you as a blackjack player and author have for anyone who thinks that they are ready to sacrifice some of their hard-earned money in a risk to get more money. And let me just say, I know nothing about gambling, so you can say pretty much anything you want.
Well, I would say don't take more money out there than you're prepared to lose. let me just say this about professional gambling. It's a lot like people who buy a diet book. They want to buy a diet book, read a few chapters, and wake up the next day skinny. And what happens is they buy it, and they start to read it, and they go, oh, this actually involves work. And the same thing is true with professional gambling. To actually have an edge, involves a lot of work and a lot of study, and it's not something that you can just learn quickly. But to people who are going to go to Las Vegas and want to have a good time, I would tell them, A, only take money you can afford to lose. B, make sure you join the club at the casino and show them your club card, because you'll get all kinds of perks and stuff for using that. So at least you'll get something back.
And C, buy Richard Munchkin's book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers. Munch.
And also, if you want to go check out one of my movies, pick one besides Dance or Die.
Well, watch the YouTube clips that I provide. Those are the best that you're going to get from Dance or Die. And then pick out from a series of Richard Munchkin movies. What are your two favorites?
My two favorites, boy, that's hard to say. I guess Ring of Fire, the first Ring of Fire is one of my favorites, for a number of reasons. One of them being, I met my wife at that time, and my brother and I wrote the script together, and it, as I say, it kind of elevated the company to a new level. The other one is probably a movie that'd be really hard to find, but it was called Texas Payback, and it was a Century Film Partners movie. Yeah, so that's what I would say.
I'll have to track that one down. Well, Munch, it is time for me to call somebody else to do another interview. But I want to thank you. You stepped in yesterday. We had a little bit of a miscommunication between myself and what was supposed to be the guest yesterday. I called up Munch thinking that I wasn't going to ever have that guest, and he stepped in to fill in. So Munch, thank you, and we're going to get you back on the show in the next probably 2 or 3 months to talk some more PM City Lights as my quest to write more and more about the company continues.
Okay, I'm happy to do it.
And once again, Munch's book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, can be picked up at Amazon.com. And check out any of his movies that you may find in stores, especially Dance or Die. Munch, thanks for coming on the show.
Okay, thank you.
This is Greg Connolly with the Your Video Store Shelf Podcast. See ya.